is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, April 5th, 2024. And today will be better than yesterday. Working from the Schwenk Studios back in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home in Montana. And this morning, Taylor, that means generating my top five teams in baseball. What do you think?
I love it, Buster. Here's the thing, everyone. We're going to do something a little different. We're recording the show on Thursday. You've probably noticed the shows come out early on Friday. Now that we're in season, we're going to stick to that at least for a little bit. We're trying something different out here. We're not going to have game highlights on the Friday morning show because, you know, when we're recording this, we don't have them. So we're taking a different approach. You guys like to hear from Buster. I want to hear from Buster. I want to know who he thinks is at the top of the sport right now. I think this is a great way to fill out the open for the Friday show. And hopefully more people listen because it's out first thing in the morning.
But for the record, I will say this. Doing the top five is not nearly as hard right now as doing number 29 and number 30 because I'm totally torn between picking the Rockies or the Athletics, Taylor.
Well, maybe
I'm really struggling with number 29 and 30.
Well, maybe that's part of the bit too. You give us your top five and then you give us like your bottom two or three. Because that'll slide up and down all season long, I'm sure.
Well, and the Athletics, this for today, you and I talking, they have to be number 30 because we just got breaking news on them just a few minutes ago. So we'll have the Athletics at number 30. We got the Rockies at 29. Number one for me, and you can chime in with some comments, Taylor, as I go through this list. Number one for me, not Shohei Ohtani's team, but the Atlanta Braves at number one. What do you think?
Wow. I was really thinking, honestly, I would go Yankees personally. I'm shocked by that.
No, I got to see more.
All right.
I got to see more from the Yankees. They are not number one. Number two, I got the Dodgers. Mm-hmm, what do you think?
Yeah, that sounds good to me. One or two, I think that sounds appropriate for them.
Okay, the number one team in the American League, your Baltimore Orioles. And it was a great series. Comeback wins against the Kansas City Royals. Not only, you know, are the Orioles impressive so far this year, their minor league team is blowing everybody out. And I'd say this too, like, you know, the Royals, I thought I really gained a lot of respect for them in that series against the Orioles because here they go toe-to-toe with the American League's best team. And you know what? They had a chance to win the series.
Yeah, the Orioles really had to gut it out. They needed to walk-off wins. I was trying to make Jeff have his bold prediction be the Royals to win the AL Central. He went with the Tigers, against his hometown team. But I had a lot of respect for them. Their pitching looked good. Salvador Perez looks good. Bobby Witt Jr. I mean, we're talking, you know, Orioles number three.
Impact. Number four, but, how about Cole Reagans?
Oh, my God.
He was great.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Shout out to the Royals.
There we go. And number four, I've got the Yankees. Okay, not number one, number two, or number three, but they had a great series against the Astros, so I rewarded him there. You on board with that one?
I am on board with that one, and a good series against the Snakes as well. You know, they won an 11 on Wednesday night. You know, they're showing that they've got some grit to them, which they didn't at all last season. So good on the Yankees. Good start here.
And number five, the Phillies. I just think they're incredibly dangerous. And, you know, Bryce Harper had a slow start to the season, but he breaks out with that three-homer game the other night. So those are my top five. Braves, Dodgers, Orioles, Yankees, Phillies. Taylor?
Love it, Buster. I like this bit. Let's keep it going. And let us know if you agree, disagree. Maybe we'll put something out on social with your top five so people can scream at you. I know that's your favorite thing about social media.
Yeah, that seems like it happens every day. All right, Shohei Ohtani got his first Dodger homer on Wednesday night. Here's what it sounded like.
Rogers set the pitch. Swung on and drilled. Deep right field. There it is. The first home run is a Los Angeles Dodger for Shohei Ohtani. And it's 5-3. Oh, no doubter to the pavilion in right center. As Shohei showed him.
Yeah, Tim Nevert with that call on the Dodgers radio network. He told reporters after the game he was relieved. Not Tim Nevert. Shohei Ohtani said he was relieved. I mentioned the Oakland Athletics have announced that they will be moving to Sacramento to play the 25 through 27 seasons. They also, Sacramento has, there's an option on the lease for the A's to play in Sacramento for the 2028 season. We're going to be talking about that coming up with Carl Ravitch, with Todd Radom. And the New York Mets agreed to a deal with veteran starter Julio Teheran. The Mets are struggling for starting pitching early this year because of a number of injuries. And speaking of injuries, Yuri Perez, who's one of the great young pitchers in baseball last year, well, he needs Tommy John surgery, which is a real bummer for a Marlins team that has gotten off to a horrific start, Taylor. What else you got?
Buster, I am fully back in the mix on the College Game Day podcast. Baseball tonight, my number one priority. But we've got episode about, we talked about it the other day, but some draft talk with Matt Miller. They also did a college basketball show ahead of the Final Four. They're going to do an episode following the Final Four on Saturday. So it'll be out late Saturday night into Sunday. And then probably a little more draft talk next week. So College Game Day podcast, you can listen on this platform or watch it on YouTube.
All aboard. It's the Rabbit Train with Carl Ravitch.
The Rabbit Train will be in Texas again this weekend, Rabby. We've got the Astros, we've got the Texas Rangers, and boy, we fell into a great pitching matchup. We have Dane Dunning, who was very underrated from last year, but we get Renaud Blanco, who threw the first no-hitter of the 2024 season on Sunday night, if everything holds.
Let's hope everything holds. That's really neat. It was a no-hitter out of nowhere, and if he can be on Sunday night, we'll see if he can become the first in forever to actually pitch back-to-back no-hitters. Although I assume now there's a little more of a scouting report on his changeup that wasn't there maybe before that. I mean, that's the beauty of your first start, let alone the surprise start because of injuries. But, yeah, it'll be a little test, but I'm looking forward to seeing Blanco. To me, I remember Mike Petriello, Buster, telling everybody the splitter was going to be the new pitch with all the Japanese pitchers. I've seen a whole bunch of changeups from righties, in on righties, and Blanco did an unbelievable job that night.
Yeah, Gavin Stone, we had on Sunday Night Baseball last week, had an incredible changeup. We got data that the Blanco's changeup is not only is he throwing it more, but it's a better changeup. So it'll be interesting to see if he's able to do that. And, yeah, I think we have to, at the beginning of the broadcast, do the Johnny Vandermeer treatment. Could Blanco be the first guy since Johnny Vandermeer, the only second player in history to go to back-to-back? And I also, I'm sure we'll talk about this too, what I think – in my time covering baseball, one of the ultimate troll jobs, okay? This was Alex Bregman right after the Astros clinched the 2023 American League West in the Astros clubhouse celebration. Give a listen.
A lot of people were wondering what it was going to be like if the Astros didn't win the division. I guess we'll never know.
So they go crazy. They overtook the Rangers. Great disappointment for Texas in the next to last day of the regular season. But you know what happened next? The Rangers go 11-0 on the road in the postseason. And then at the championship parade after the Rangers won the World Series, here's Corey Seager.
I just got one thing to say. Everybody was wondering what would happen if the Rangers didn't win the World Series. I guess we'll never know.
And then, of course, he drops the mic. He would not have been one of the first people, Carl, that I would have guessed would have done that.
I agree with you. I think that's the beauty of clubhouses. I think that we've heard from Boach about the personality of Corey Seager, that there is a dark side, meaning there's a real good sense of humor in there. There's a competitiveness that you don't necessarily see. He's so stoic out there, and he walks around with his tripod, every time we're there for hours on hours before the game. But as the leader, who was like that a little bit, Buster, when I was younger? And he became much more of a known trash talker. But in the beginning, Larry Bird came out of Indiana State as a supremely confident guy, but you didn't really know it. He was the hick from French Lick. And then as his career blossomed, you realize, this is a guy that's, he's the most competitive you'll ever meet. And he's certainly not afraid to throw a jab out like that. I think he did it with after they won a championship, something about, I believe it was 4-4-4, maybe Hakeem Olajuwon wants at City Hall, which right away you're like, that's what you want from the guy that is sort of the face of the franchise. So in a lot of ways, I think I'm brought back to the Larry Bird speech when Seager did the same thing.
I hope I'm right here, but I think he said about Moses Malone, was it like Moses Malone, eat something, right?
I think it was something about Moses. I think maybe Moses. Somebody said we could grab four people from the street and beat them. There was something, but it was Bird at City Hall with that kind of whoa, what did he? All right. There's my guy. I love that. And I'm sure the Rangers players felt that way and their fans too. It was tremendous.
Oh, yeah. And the thing about Larry Bird, and, you know, I love that Larry Bird trash talk stories, is that the other players would say the funny thing about Bird is that he never moved his mouth, but they all could hear it on the court.
Right,
but if you were sitting in the side, you didn't really get it, but he would say things under his breath that would stick with all of them. And with Corey Seager, when he did that, I love the video of it because the other Ranger players just burst out laughing. It was like that part of Corey Seager's personality came out. And I don't know about you, Carl, but last week after we were around the Rangers for a couple days, I walked away thinking a lot like I did the previous year. I'm like, you know what? This is a really this is a team that you're going to have to deal with before the end of the year. There's so much depth, but the Josh Young injury is huge for them. You know,
they had that last year.
Yeah, yep. Evan Grant, in Dallas Morning News reported yesterday that as opposed to the original 4 to 6 week timeline they're talking about, it's more like 8 to 10 weeks. That's devastating, but this team is so deep with all that high-end pitching potentially joining the team as the season goes along.
Yeah, the first takeaway prior to the injury was a reminder how good they are and how they're going to get so much better, assuming the health of Scherzer and DeGrom. I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of a conversation we were having last year. Like, just think about what they have coming back. And look, Young was hurt last year. I think the biggest benefit of their long run last year in the World Series title is that sort of calm that comes with an injury to Josh Young. If it's 4 weeks, if it's 10 weeks, like, we've dealt with that before. We lost him last year. He came back. He was dynamite in the postseason. Young is quickly establishing himself as a guy that doesn't necessarily need a lot of seasoning, doesn't need to be, you know, baked very long. He's ready to go when he shows up. He didn't have a long spring training, comes out of the gate and playing tremendous. So I think there's a huge benefit in having gone through what they did and winning it all. Bochy certainly leads this charge, but not to be too impacted or affected by something like this that's happening to them. And they're loaded. They're going to be great. The AL West is the best division in baseball, given the three teams there. I think Seattle is so good, and we know Houston's really good. And I love the National League West too, but I'm huge on the AL West, and the Rangers are as good, no question, as the other two teams. Wouldn't surprise me at all if they win.
And Mike Petriello, in our preparation for our conference call this week, you know, sent all of us a book of data, and he basically said, look, the Astros, you know, start has not been good. They lost four straight to the Yankees, but he said starting pitching has been excellent and the everyday lineup has been excellent, and it's just a bullpen issue at this point. And you would expect that Josh Hader is going to be better, you know, arguably statistically the best reliever in baseball history.
Yeah, the two-headed monster they have at the end, I mean that's, you know, just kind of circling back to the Rangers thing. Even last night I was watching, and, you know, the Rangers have a lead, and I think there's maybe two on, you know, and the closer's in the game, and it's a warning track shot that almost tied the game. I think the back end of the Rangers bullpen is a little bit of a concern, where I would absolutely have zero concern about the Astros moving forward. You know, I agree with people, Buster, and I'm sure they've said the same thing to you, and you've heard it, like, you're going to lose four in a row at some point in the season. It really sucks when it's the first four games, because it feels like it's a very deep sand trap to get out of, as opposed to when you're two games over and you lose four, you fall two games under. It doesn't feel as punitive. But the Astros are going to be right there in the playoffs race at the end of the year. And their back end of the bullpen, I find it impossible to believe, is going to be a reason that they're not. Like, that's like low on the list of concerns.
Shohei Ohtani last night breaks through. He hits his first home run of the season. And it was very interesting, Carl, and you were around his first two games this year in Korea against the Padres. We saw him again over the weekend against the St. Louis Cardinals. It was a little bit of a surprise to me that Ohtani essentially acknowledged, it's a relief to hit that first home run. But you could see in his plate appearances that he was beginning to press.
To me, it felt like every swing of his was an attempt to hit a homer from Korea. Every one of his swings, you know, look, the guy is a tremendous performer, all-star, great hitter, but it just felt like to the naked eye, there were times he was overswinging and his head was pulling off the ball. I'm sure none of those things were happening, or if they were, they would address them right away. But it just felt like this is a guy who's just not in sync, which again, I think as a human being, you know, the reaction might be, well, this has to have something to do with the stuff going on around him with all the gambling stuff and Ipe and the investigations. Like, I'm sorry, you can be the greatest compartmentalizer on the planet. I have to believe at some point it impacts you. I don't think he's a robot. So between the what it looked like trying to hit every ball over the wall, still was making hard contact, though. Even in Korea, there were a couple of warning track shots. He does seem to be unique in his ability to not let that stuff really dramatically impact him. But his first one, I think, for every player, the first hit, the first homer, especially with the expectations, the contract, that's a big deal. And I would absolutely believe there's a lot of relief.
Yeah, and I think it was good that he spoke to the reporters after the game, after hitting his first home run, because I definitely, in the time around the Dodgers, picked up this sort of, you know, this low-lying feeling of, you know what, he's got to make himself available more often. As you know, he went through his time with the Angels where he was basically wasn't asked to do any media. You know, he hurt his elbow last year. It was weeks before he spoke with reporters again. I think the expectation is going to be a little different with the Dodgers because you've got a lot of established players in there, Carl, who are not going to want to be left to answer for him every day, and especially in those games when he doesn't play that well. So I think maybe that's a good sign of change to come there. What do you think?
Yeah, I hope. I mean, two things on that. I thought Dave Roberts' first reaction to not having Ipe around, I shouldn't say first, probably down on the list because of all the actual reactions he had when he heard the news, but down on the list was, well, this might actually create less of a buffer between us and Shohei Ohtani, meaning the communication may be less stilted, less challenging, less difficult. There may be more access directly to him. That's one. And the second was when we were in LA this past weekend, I was speaking with somebody who works in Major League Baseball, and the rules that have been put in place because of Ohtani are fairly significant, and some that you wouldn't think would be necessary, especially as you said, with like a guy like Betts or Freeman, whoever's on their team, Kershaw. But this person was telling me, like, there are places that still photographers can't go. They can't walk in front of the dugout. They are literally prevented from taking pictures at certain times. And I said, really? Like, I don't even understand that. Like, what does that mean? You can't stand in front of a dugout. That seemed odd. And I, you know, we covered Ichiro forever. I don't recall that type of wall being put up, and I don't quite understand it. If somebody were to explain it to me, why those things are necessary. It doesn't feel like it's a safety issue. These people are professionals. So yeah, I think like the two takeaways are, I hope there's more accessibility, but even more so in the clubhouse. Like, we're all the same team. We're not one and then, you know, 29 others. We're the same team. And I think that's a little bit of what Doc was trying to get at. I think there's something to that. Like, you know, let's all, we're here together. We're a group, not isolated islands and different cabs, et cetera.
Yeah. When I covered, you know, as a beat writer with teams, the Yankees 90 to 2001, it was always interesting to me, you know, when people, you know, there'd be player, very rarely there'd be players on the teams that I covered that where they'd say, look, I'm not talking to the media. When Chuck Knoblauch was going through his throwing issue with the Yankees.
Yeah.
And you know, you'd write so-and-so was not available to comment. And I think, you know, some casual fans might look at that and say, you know what, you know, writers, they're not obligated to talk to you. And my feeling always was, I don't care if they talk to me personally. But I know that it's actually more meaningful to teammates. Like, teammates want players to answer questions for themselves. And when I've covered teams, I've had veterans come up to me, like when a young player had a bad game and they said, hey, did, You know, did a young Taylor Schwenk, did he speak to you guys after the game? Oh, he did. Okay, that's good. Like, other players are monitoring that because they want fairness. They don't like having that burden on their shoulders. And I did wonder when Ohtani signed with a very veteran team with the Dodgers, how those veterans would expect him to handle that situation. And so far, you know, maybe what we've seen from him is that it's going to be different with the Dodgers than it was with the Angels.
Yeah, I will say this, and you know this, but just quickly, like, I would bet if you ask Freddie and Mookie, the attention that Ohtani gets relative to their own attention or anybody they've ever seen is so astronomically different. I mean, it is different. There is no doubt about it. The amount of attention he gets, certainly from the Japanese media, but certainly the media here, it is different. So there are some guardrails I think I would understand just in terms of sheer number, but it is different. There's no doubt about it.
All right. A surprise team for you, good or bad, that's caught your eyes early this season?
I would say the Red Sox are a surprise. And again, you have to couch all these things with teams they're playing, the Oakland A's or the Sacramento A's. But I think the encouraging part about what the Red Sox have done is pitch incredibly well. And that was the huge question mark going in. So, you know, is Andrew Bailey's impact on this team and this staff something that's going to last as they get into tougher competition, or is it not? But the fact that they are on the road on the West Coast, tough place to, they pitched with the Mariners, who are really, really good as far as their starting staff and their bullpen. They're just good as a pitching staff. I think that's the biggest surprise, because I think a lot of people, you know, given the lack of activity, would think that they'd be, you know, 1-5 or whatever, 0-6 going in. They were gonna struggle even against the A's, as you know. Boston is there is no such thing as glass half full. The glass is either empty or it's spilling over the top. There's no such thing as half. It's never half. So I think that they would probably be the biggest surprise. I love the Pirates and the way they're playing, but you kind of saw that. So I'd say the Red Sox are the biggest surprise in a positive way. And again, similarly, Buster, the Astros, like, they get swept by the Yankees. If I'm an Astros fan, I'm not losing sleep over it. It's a big thing for the Yankees, and Soto was great. But again, you got to take all this stuff with what it is, which is the first two series, and some not at home yet.
I'm glad you mentioned Andrew Bailey, who, as you know, is regarded as one of the best coaches in baseball. And I do wonder, you know, if in fact Alex Cora does play out his option and winds up going to another team as a free agent after this year, if Andrew is going to be someone that the Red Sox would look at as being a possible managerial candidate, because he's that respected. Yeah. And I do think, you know, if you're going to manage in Boston, you know, sometime our friend Aaron Boone gets criticized by Yankee fans because he drinks a glass of happiness every day. I don't think that's a bad thing. Andrew Bailey's got that type of personality. Like, he's waking up every day thinking that he's going to look for ways to fix problems, and, you know, so maybe he'll emerge as a candidate, because certainly the pitching, you're right, has been the big surprise for them. You touched on the Oakland Athletics, the Sacramento Athletics. We get the announcement on Thursday from the A's that they're going to play in Sacramento at least 3 years. The deal with Sacramento is for 2025 through the 2027 season, with an option for 2028. And we don't even have a shovel in the ground for a ballpark in Las Vegas. To me, Carl, it's just a reminder of how, you wish that baseball wasn't just a loose confederacy of 30 private businesses. You wish that the other owners would hold John Fisher to a higher standard, because this is an awful day. And the idea, and I'm going to be really curious to see what the Player Association says about all this, because the idea that you're going to have a major league team playing in a minor league park makes no sense to me. And the way this is played out makes no sense to me. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's terrible. If you're going to commit to 3 or 4 years, then figure out a way to stay in front of people that have rooted for you forever. Like, stay in Oakland until the move is ready for Las Vegas. But going to another place in California away from people who've been loyal, that's your fault that the ballpark sucks and it's got toilets that don't flush and all those things that are problems. They should have been addressed. The whole Oakland move is very, very difficult to sort of stomach. I don't understand it. I don't understand how they couldn't have come to an agreement. I don't understand the owner and the decisions he's made, and why, when you watch them play now, what the hell are the next 3 years or 4 years going to look like? I mean, I don't have any faith that this is going to go well. And it feels like anybody that's got to go play in Sacramento, when you're used to going to Oakland against an organization that's showing no signs of really being invested until we move to Las Vegas, is very off-putting. It's off-putting. It's kind of repulsive. So the Sacramento thing is not the Blue Jays when they were, you know, out of their country and having to play somewhere else. This is a choice, and you could have chose to stay and figured out a way to make it work in front of people who have been screwed over by a variety of teams. That part doesn't sit well. It's really bad.
And I don't have the fine print in front of me, but based on what I've read about this move, basically the A's are leaving because of a difference of one Cody Bellinger contract for this year. You know, I mean, you're talking about a few tens of millions of dollars. Not only why doesn't that work for John Fisher, the owner of the Athletics? Can you please find a way to stay in Oakland? But if you're the other owners in this industry that's worth billions and billions and billions of dollars, you can't compel the guy to figure it out, because it makes them all look bad. I don't get it. It's maddening. And you really wish this would spur conversations among all owners. Like, boy, if you're going to be in our club, you need to set a standard. You can't be the member of the, you know, if you compare it to a golf club, the person who's out there spitting on the course, playing in a T-shirt, running around, cursing everybody. Because that's kind of how it feels with John Fisher right now. He's embarrassing all of them.
It's a reflection of everybody. No, I agree with you. And by the way, I mean, you think about it. You got a commissioner who has come out and said, I'm done in 5 years. I would imagine that is a difficult position to be in, because of the fact, as you said, you're basically dealing with 30 different fiefdoms. Yep. You'd like to think there's a collective thinking going on, but in the end, there's not. And whoever is in the position is fielding 30 different calls with 30 different opinions, because they look in the mirror and say, how does this impact me, as opposed to too often, how does this look for the industry? How does it look for Major League Baseball? It looks terrible.
Yeah. And the last labor stoppage, when all the players were focused on Rob Manfred and, you know, he's ruining baseball, blah, 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 the social media stuff. I just laugh. I'm like, Rob Manfred is not your problem. No. Your problem are the 30 owners and how they do their business, as opposed to Rob, who is essentially their messenger. Right. All right, Carl, thanks for doing this. I'll see you in Texas.
Look forward to it. See you, Buster.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world, or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. He's known as the Todd Father. Todd, how you doing?
Buster, it's so good to be back. Great to see you.
It's good to see you, too. And I think next week I'll have to ask you about those Red Sox, your Red Sox, and the great start they're off to. But, you know, we got sad news from the Red Sox this week about the passing of Larry Lucchino at age 78. Larry was someone who I got to know when I was actually covering the Padres. He was part of an incoming ownership group there. I don't think that we can overstate his impact on baseball. And I assume at some point, Todd, that he's going to be honored at the Hall of Fame, maybe the Buck O'Neill Award or something like that. But it seems inevitable that'll happen, because he has had such an influence.
Yeah, I mean, Buster, we've got executives in the Hall of Fame, like, we'll name a couple of names, Tom Yawkey, Bowie Kuhn. There are builders, there are executives. Larry Lucchino deserves a place there. We can go backwards. We'll start with the Red Sox. He came aboard with this ownership group in 2002, instrumental in saving, preserving, and renewing Fenway Park, instrumental in the construction of Petco Park in San Diego and the revival of that franchise, as you said. And of course, we associate him probably most closely with Baltimore, with Janet Marie Smith and Camden Yards. So a real visionary. And someone who I had the opportunity to have spent some time with along the way, somebody who did not suffer fools gladly, as the saying goes.
No,
But my interactions were always great. And the last time I spent some time with him was actually at the Worcester, Massachusetts Art Museum in 2021. My work was part of an exhibit there. I remember us talking about it here on the pod, and spent some time with Larry, just kind of like social stuff, talking about the Worcester franchise, talking about the Red Sox, a Hall of Famer for sure.
Yeah, he had a reputation, you say, for not suffering fools. He was so combative as someone who covered him, but he was always advocating, which, you know, it's not a surprise. His background was as a lawyer. He worked with Edward Bennett Williams. That was his connection that, you know, wound up getting locked in with baseball. And as Dieter Ruhl said, you know, on the podcast the other day, he also will go down in history as the guy who mentored Theo Epstein, who's going to go down in history as the greatest general manager ever. So a major legacy for Larry Lucchino. And if anybody has had a chance, follow Janet Marie Smith on social media, on X. She has been linking all the stories written about Larry and his impact on the sport. And it's moving how much content she has been posting about Larry, and you can tell his influence on her. Today we got news of the A's moving to Sacramento, and not surprisingly, you were the first one to come out with a logo of the A's and what it might look like. Explain.
Well, Buster, I put out some visual snark immediately after the news came down, the Athletics logo, but it doesn't say Oakland Athletics. It says Sacramento Athletics of Las Vegas. And I immediately regretted it because it seemed kind of crass and insensitive. And I have to say that you probably feel the same way. You feel all the feels for the folks in Oakland who've stuck with that franchise. You and I can remember a time when that franchise was an attendance juggernaut before Mount Davis was built in the early 90s. The Ricky Henderson teams drew very, very well. You know, it was always up and down, but there's so much history and so much heritage and World Series winners there that it feels kind of sad.
Oh, without a doubt. And you feel for the fans there who are so passionate. You know, you'd ask players about where the toughest places to play, and they would predictably mention Yankee Stadium, right? Because of the size of the crowds and the stuff that was being yelled. And then so many would mention Oakland because of the passion of the fan base there. And it is heartbreaking. Now, with a story, you never know. There could be twists and turns. You know, My mantra has always been, you don't believe anything till someone puts a shovel in the dirt, and we'll see if that happens with the A's franchise in Las Vegas. Every year since you started coming on the podcast, you've had a theme in which, you know, weekly you presented some sort of a topic, and this year's theme is the ballpark and beyond. Please explain.
Well, there's so much really fun, engaging baseball history that took place away from the ballpark, away from the field of play. And it allows us to, you know, get out of major league cities if we want to go on a little road trip every single week, the likes of which we've done for several years now. So the ballpark and beyond is literally that. It's fun stories that, you know, are going to be major league, minor league, Negro leagues, out of this country. We're going to go on a very expansive trip all season long, the ballpark and beyond. It is what it says it is, Buster.
And this year you're starting the theme with?
Well, I kind of love this one. So, Buster, a building housing the Boston Police Department currently sits at the corner of Ruggles Street and Tremont Avenue in Boston's Roxbury section. But at the beginning of the 20th century, it was 940 Columbus Avenue, and it was the site of Michael T. McGreevy's third base saloon, so named because, quote, it was your last stop on your way home. More importantly, for our purposes, it has been called America's first sports bar, and it was conveniently located near both the South End grounds, the home of the Boston Beaneaters, these are today's Atlanta Braves, and the Huntington Avenue grounds, which was the first home of the Boston Red Sox. The bar's proprietor, Michael T. McGreevy, was the son of an Irish immigrant day laborer. He opened his first saloon in 1894, and the location of 940 Columbus Avenue opened in 1900. In September 1897, McGreevy organized a group of some 200 diehard Bean Eater fans who journeyed by train to Baltimore, where they cheered on their team as they tangled with the Orioles for the National League pennant. The group later became known as the Royal Rooters, and they shifted their allegiance to the new American League club in town, today's Red Sox. The colorful and boisterous Rooters traveled back and forth between Pittsburgh and Boston for baseball's first modern World Series in 1903, gaining widespread fame. As for the bar, it became the de facto headquarters for Boston baseball fans all year round. It was decorated from floor to ceiling with baseball photographs and memorabilia, a veritable museum of baseball collectibles, which included an extensive and impressive array of game-used equipment. Light fixtures hung from the ceiling. They were composed of illuminated frosted glass baseballs, which were attached to game-used bats of stars such as Cap Anson, Cy Young, Nap Lajoie, and King Kelly. McGreevy's famous nickname, Nuff Said, was described as, quote, an explosive expression that he employed to end barroom disputes. The bar moved to its third and final location in 1915 before it was done in by Prohibition 5 years later. McGreevy donated his collection of photos to the print department of the Boston Public Library, where it still resides today, described by the library as, quote, one of the most important collections of early baseball images in the United States. As for the final iteration of the saloon itself, a couple of blocks away from the location of 940 Columbus, finally at Ruggles and Tremont, McGreevy leased the bar to the Boston Public Library for $91.66 a month, and it was reborn as the Roxbury Crossing branch of the BPL. The site of that building is now Northeastern Crossing, part of the university. His collection was displayed in a storefront window at Filene's Department Store in downtown Boston in 1939 for baseball's centennial. McGreevy died at the age of 77 in 1943. So the next time you go to a sports bar, think of Michael T. Nuff Said McGreevy, the Royal Rooters, and the Third Base Tavern, your last stop on your way home, which we remember today as we've traveled to the ballpark and beyond.
Man, Todd, you weren't kidding. That is a fun that is a fun one for sure. And this is going to be great this summer. What a great idea again by you. And as we get ready for this week's quiz, just coincidentally, our friend Sarah Langs just dropped in, and I'm going to invite her to be the third person who gets to take your quiz. Although, Taylor, I think you and I, we might be at a bit of a disadvantage here with a trivia question.
What do you think, Taylor? Oh, boy, I am
a heavy hitter. This Sarah's is not got that Sarah big brain Abbott, over there. Right? Who was guessing, guessing. Sarah Langs is going to be coming in with a lot of information on the trivia. Sarah, are you game to join us?
I am, but I want to be clear that I'm being punished for being on time to the podcast recording. Because now if I look bad, I will have been look bad because I was on time. But hi, Todd. I'm so in, of course.
So good to see you, Sarah. So if you're game for this, let's jump on in. You want to do it?
Absolutely.
All right. So here's this week's question, the first of 2024. With the Athletics seemingly heading for Vegas via Sacramento, here is this week's question. As of today, how many ballparks have they called home since their inception in Philly in 1901? This is total regular home parks, not one-offs. Is it 4, 5, 6, or 7? How many home ballparks, permanent home ballparks, as of this very minute, have the Athletics called home? Is it 4, 5, 6, or 7?
Wow. That is a good one. I like that question. Taylor, why don't you go first?
I have to say, this is an audio format. I hate to see Sarah Lang's wheels turning. I feel like it makes me feel very vulnerable. I'm going to go 5B.
I've got 5B. Sarah, what do you got?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm not going to be the same as everyone. So our options were 4, 5, and 6. I'll go 6.
Well, everybody is incorrect because amazingly, considering the Athletics' journey across the continent, they have only played in 4 permanent ballparks up to this very minute. But we're going to be adding to that soon enough.
I was going to guess four. That's what I remembered. But then I second guessed myself and I'm like, there had to have been one that I missed somewhere along the way, which is why I was like, my answer plus one. So I, again, Todd, I overthought it.
You do this all the time, Buster. You're very on brand.
All right, Todd. Well, thanks for doing this. And thanks for lassoing Sarah into our weekly quiz.
Oh, that was really fun. Good to see everybody.
0096. This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs of MLB.com. She needs no introduction this week because she just joined us with Todd Radom. Sarah, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Still reeling from also overthinking that question. When Taylor saw my eyes moving the wheelchair, I was thinking, okay, Philly, Kansas City, Oakland, and kind of trying to think through all of that, and I totally overthought it.
Yeah, if you had gotten that one right, I don't think I would have invited you back for it, you know, because I just knew that it would have been a summer of humiliation. All right, before we get to this week's numbers, you were on the conference prep call that we have every week to prepare for Sunday Night Baseball. And I think this week we're going to wind up doing a start of a fun feature, which is to present players through things that you might see as a fan watching on television and maybe something you don't see. We're talking about maybe having conversations with players about their shoes, which the shoe game in baseball, Eduardo explained to us, has really been ramped up this year. I've suggested tattoos, you know, having players talk about tattoos that they have. And I told the story about Tyler Glasnow, who, when we did an interview in spring training 4 or 5 years ago when he was with the Pirates, asking him about tattoos, assuming he had none, but he had one on the inside of his lower lip because he lost a bet with a friend. And we've heard from Eduardo about how players, players wear perfume. I think you suggested, right, necklaces? You want to hear more about players with necklaces? So with that in mind, though, that being the prism that we're going to look at players through, give me a player that you'd like to hear about this weekend. Rangers, Astros.
Absolutely. So I will say I did mention the jewelry. Thinking about Kike Hernandez, who we had mic'd up last week. He had a very interesting beaded necklace. I wanted more info on. I hope next time we have the Dodgers, we get to find that out from him. But for me, I'll go with Adolis Garcia. I believe he's been wearing these cleats this year. They're like fuzzy. Like they look like they should be almost like chenille or like something fuzzy, like a fuzzy sweater you would have. And so I want more info on how he settled on that. And all of these guys have such great shoe game, such interesting jewelry, everything that they wear these days. So I can't wait to hear more about it and what all of the inspiration is.
Yeah, because these are not random choices. You know, that they're based on something, and it'll be interesting to hear those stories for sure. All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three.
Number three is five. So the Dodgers are now 9 games into the season, and they have yet to score fewer than 5 runs in any game they play. So they are one of just 6 teams to score at least 5 runs in each of their first 9 or more games since 1900. Last team to do was Cleveland in their first 10 in 2002. Cleveland also did that in their first 10 in 1999. Before that, not since 1936, but the Reds also first 10. The 1932 Yankees did it in their first 13. You knew some Yankee team of that era would be on this list. And the 1903 Pirates did it in their first 10. So just an incredible list. And you think of the amazing offensive teams we have seen, even in the last 10 years. I mean, the 2016 Cubs, off to an amazing start. The Braves last year and this year have been insane. And then no team has done this since 2002. And then there's only 5 others since 1900. Pretty cool.
Number two.
Number two is We'll go with three for three very exciting things that Kyle Higashioka did on Wednesday, one inning. So in the top of an inning, I think it was the sixth, but don't quote me on that. He threw out two runners on the base pass. Already a very good inning for any catcher behind the plate. But then the bottom of that inning, he hit a home run. So he is one of just a handful of guys in the expansion era, which goes back to 1961, to catch two runners stealing in the same inning and hit a home run in that inning all together. So the last guy to do this was Benji Molina in 2000. Joe Ferguson did it in 1977, Ted Simmons in 75, Johnny Romano in 1966, and my favorite of these instances is the first one on the list. On April 14, 1961, Sammy Taylor caught two runners stealing in the top of the ninth, and then he did a walk-off home run in the bottom of the ninth. I mean, that has to be one of the greatest single game impacts as a catcher in baseball history.
Number one.
Number one is two. So on Wednesday, you were not offered in two runs. His first, I believe his first two of the season. And that was his 16th multi-homer game in his career. So he's played 489 games through that Wednesday game. That is tied for the second most multi-homer games by any player in their first 500 career games. So to be clear, he has 11 more to add on to that total. He's tied with Todd Helton and Bob Horner and trails only Ralph Kiner, who had 17. So it's very realistic to think that Yordan could add at least one, if not two, multi-homer games over the next 11 to entirely lead this list.
And that would be pretty remarkable. Before you go, we're going to have a bonus Astros number here, which you dug out the other day after Blanco threw his no-hitter. You know, I texted you and I asked the question because the Astros had so many no-hitters, it seems like, over the last couple of decades and maybe throughout their history compared to other teams. You know, how many straight no-hitters they've had since they were no-hit? And you dug out some interesting numbers there.
This was one of my favorite questions you've ever asked me. It yielded such a great note. So the last time the Astros were no-hit was in 2012 when Matt Keene's perfect game. Since then, they've thrown seven no-hitters if we include the playoffs. That is the most consecutive no-hitter by a team without being no-hit. But to me, the most amazing part of it was that they broke a tie for that longest streak with themselves. They also had a streak of six between no-hitter and I believe 1969 by Jim Maloney and then being no-hit by Carlos Zambrano in 2008. So they've had the two longest streaks of this, which is really, really cool to think about.
All right. And I got to give credit to my question. It wasn't my idea. It was actually Steve Sparks, the Astros announcer, who texted me to ask me about that. And, you know, Sparks, he's a regular listener and follows your work, Sarah. And we both greatly appreciate it.
Well, thanks to him for the great question. I really appreciate that.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for a Friday. We got a couple voicemails. First up, something on the Royals.
Hey, Buster. This is Jacob from Oakland. First, before I get to my question, I want to give a shout-out to all the voters in Kansas City who rejected paying for a billionaire's new ballpark. I think that was great, and it makes me wonder, because that was so resounding of a loss for the owners of the Royals, I wonder if it would have been the same had that vote been on the ballot in Las Vegas, how that would have worked out. Anyway, my question is there any chance that the Royals will now end up becoming one of the new expansion teams in Portland or Nashville or Salt Lake City, just like the A's have done in Vegas. All right, that's my question. Thank you.
So my instinct is no, I don't think so. They're pretty well-established franchise. Their owner, John Sherman, seems to like it there. And I don't know. This is one of those cases we've seen a lot of examples, and this happened with the Marlins with their ballpark, where the voters are sort of bypassed and they go through like a city council or some legislative body and a special deal is made behind the scenes. I don't know if that's possible. Or, you know, is that door absolutely slammed shut? Maybe there's going to be some negotiations going forward. I'll have to look into that a little bit more.
Hi, this is Daniel Lee from Northfield, Minnesota. Dodger fan who now lives in the Twin Cities or Cities area of Minnesota. Hi, Buster. Hi, Taylor. Congratulations on the new little girl. I have a little one myself in my arms right now. My question is, when I was younger, my dad bought me the CD with all these great baseball songs on it. And I remember the Dodgers song, which was about the Dodgers playing the Giants and coming back in a big ninth inning comeback victory. And I'm just wondering, what's Buster's favorite baseball song? And what's Taylor's favorite baseball song, too? Hope you all are well and take care. Bye.
So mine, I think, would be the Willie Mays song, which I'm assuming you've heard, Taylor. Yes?
No, I have not heard the Willie Mays song.
All right, well, give a listen to this.
Say hey, fellas, what's your name?
Say who?
Say Willie. Say hey.
Say who?
Swinging at the plate. Say hey.
Say who?
Say Willie. That Giants kid is great.
So that's a song that I love, Taylor. What do you think?
I love that. I've never heard that before. It's catchy. It's jazzy. I feel like it's a great like relic of the times. I really enjoyed that. That one was fun.
Nice. What do you got?
Well, obviously, you know, Orioles Magic is a great one. I know you find that abhorrent and corny. This is really, I guess, do people know who Bell and Sebastian are? It's like a folk singing duo here. But they have a song called Piazza, New York Catcher that I really enjoy. Let us know what your favorite baseball songs are. I guess there's got to be a bunch of them. If there was a whole CD that our Bleacher Tweeter had.
Yeah, we have to get some nominations on that one.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Let's go to the next voicemail.
Hi, my name is Kevin Doyle, and originally from Rhode Island, but calling down from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, home of the Myrtle Beach Pelicans. My question really is, why isn't there more talk and discussion and questioning about the Shohei Ohtani gambling situation? It just smells like there's more to it than his interpreter making bets using Shohei's account or whatever, as their story seems to go these days. It just seems like there's more to it than this. And I feel that if it wasn't Ohtani, there'd be much more questioning of Major League Baseball, of Ohtani himself. Thanks. Love your podcast. You guys are great. And Sarah Lang rocks. Bye.
I love that shout out for Sarah at the end. Look, that's why we had Tisha Thompson, who broke the story. And we've talked about, you know, the lingering questions that we have. Tim Kuhn, we had on last week. He talked about the lingering questions that we have. I do think that, you know, based on the explanation we've gotten so far, it makes no sense. And I've said repeatedly, I think Major League Baseball has an absolute obligation to follow this until they find out the truth, and they need to reveal the truth. And not only because whenever they don't do the right thing, whenever they bury their head in the sand, it always comes back to bite them. And I think in this case, they have to work to do the right thing for sure. And then, you know, out of respect for the other players, if discipline is required, then they have to render it. What do you think, Taylor?
Yeah, it is really weird. I mean, imagine if Patrick Mahomes was caught up in something like this, like, many news outlets would be never ending. And I feel like it has quieted down a little bit. Obviously it hasn't gone away, but definitely interesting. Last one for today right here.
This is Bruce from Jerusalem, Israel. I'm an old Brooklyn boy. I started watching the Yankees in 1961 with Mickey and Roger. I was rooting for Mickey, but he got injured. Question for Buster. With all the discussion about women being involved in baseball, how come there's no mention of Susan Waldman, who has been the radio announcer for the Yankees for 25 years? and I presume you know her since she was already there when you were a beat reporter for the Yankees. Have a great day. I enjoyed listening to your podcast.
Yeah, she's actually, she's been with, I think, through WFAN first, and then, you know, working on Yankee broadcast like almost 40 years now. And yeah, I absolutely know Susan. I think we had her on the podcast once before. Yeah. We certainly someone we talked to about John Sterling and had fun with that. There was a great story that I would encourage people to read. I think it was by Brian Hoke talking to a bunch of major league about Yankee players, about what makes Susan special. So that's certainly someone worth talking about.
Had to give her a little love here. Thanks for calling everyone all the way from the other side of the ocean. I mean, we love the tentacles of the podcast spreading far and wide. The phone number 406-404-8460. That is in the show notes if you are not scribbling it down. Thanks for calling in, everyone. Thanks for writing in. Hashtag BleacherTweets on Twitter. We're taking questions from there. We will be back on Monday. We haven't decided if we're going to do a late night pod or we'll do something early from the airport, but yeah, we'll be back on Monday. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. I think we're going late night on Sunday night, to be posted Monday morning, Taylor. We got a game in Texas and, I got an early morning flight back to Boston and actually me back to Bozeman. So yeah, well, I think that'll be the plan for Monday. All right. That's it for today. My thanks to Sarah, to Todd, to Carl, and to Taylor. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.